Welcome to the Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're doing cool. Hope you survived the political rampage. Or the display that which that was, or whatever you want to call that. But I'm not going to go politics here. Frankly, I am worn out. I am done with the politics for a little while. So this was a fun podcast to do, more in the realm of my specialty, what I love to do, my passion, what I like to be involved with, which is the mindset of athletes and all the different arrays. What do the athletes experience in the sport, after the sport, as they're learning the sport, all of that. As you know, I am a athlete mental trainer. I am not Mr. Miyagi. I help with athletes' life outside of the ring, outside of the gym, off the field, off the court, etc. Excuse me. I help keep that part of their life balanced, and I call it pure focus potential. You know, if your world outside of competing or training is not working or is not positive, it will have a major effect. And funny enough, Alistair McCall, the guest on the podcast, talks about that. Actually, we get into that. We talk about the importance of it. He actually calls it the most important thing most influential thing that can trip up an athlete, be that professional, even recreational. So that's what I do. If you want to book some mental training with me, I do 30 and 60 minute sessions of mental training. I also do sessions called mental recovery sessions, and those mental recovery sessions focus on life after sports, you know, cultivating a life beyond the identity of the athlete, either when the career is over or injury has sidelined you, and sometimes coming back from a loss as well. You know, I talk on this podcast and have in the past and will continue to about athletes' depression, what I believe should be a real diagnosis. And I talk to athletes in the mental training about that etiology, about what that feels like. And maybe you've experienced that. You can look up a couple posts, though, about what I mean in athletes' depression and see if that sounds like something you've experienced, especially if you've been a long-term athlete, and most importantly, if you've been an athlete since you were a kid and played for a long time and just don't anymore, or if you are a professional competing or amateur athlete and you see the value in a mental trainer in your camp or your corner. Look, we all know every top-performing athlete has a mental trainer in their corner these days. That's just the game now. So, and you can't argue, the mental game is part of it, and our life outside of the sport and the competing is a major influence of it. And it was a joy to talk about those things with Alistair McCall. It was, but before we get into that, a little love for my favorite mushroom probiotic, Nectar of the Gods, MyCoTe. Go to drinkmycote.com. I drink the shit out of it. As one at least every morning in my green shake. A lot of my friends have been stealing my stash, but no, that's what it's there for. That's why we have it. I give it out. Go to drinkmycote.com. Alfred's group, the crew, they're mixtures, man. No, it'll take care of you. It does different things for different people, you know. I'd like to see your response on it. If you start drinking it, please let me know what you're experiencing, what you're going through, or let them know at MyCoTe as well. But again, that's drinkmycoTe.com. You can see it all in the backgrounds of the YouTube videos and stuff. But I think that's the only ad I'm going to do. I already kind of did the athlete's depression thing and the training stuff that's coming up. But if you're hearing this podcast now, this is Friday evening on the 11th. Saturday morning at 11 o'clock Eastern tomorrow, Naudi from Functional Patterns will be on. You know him, the infamous. Him and I are going to talk nutrition all day tomorrow morning and see how that goes. You know some real competence is coming. And next week, Julia Rockledge and I want to say Mike Van Thien. It's an awesome last name. But stem cell researcher and applicator, Julia is deep into nutrition, mental health aspects of it, et cetera, and further. So a lot of competence coming next week, a lot of competence on this podcast. If you're a coach, if you're an athlete, and importantly on this podcast, if you're a parent of an athlete or even the spouse of an athlete, he really drops some dimes in here that you need to pay attention to and listen. I mean, it's not a lot of the generic stuff you may expect to come from motivational type coaches. We, Alistair and I, really get deeper into the mental mindset and the influences of that range, and especially the social influences, the epigenetic, if you will, the environmental influence on athletes during, before, and after sports. And Allie's been doing this. I call him Allie. Alistair's been doing this a long, long time. He has the resume for it. He has the humility for it, too, and the competence for it. And he spreads that in all facets, from kids to adults, athletes, amateur, pro. It was a real joy to talk to Alistair McCall.
Sounds good to me. How long will it be?
Oh, man, and basically until your rampage comes out, my friend. I am aiming to talk until I hit that button and you go off on some cognitive rampage and then wipe your brow, something like that, and then you'll be like, yep, and it'll just feel like it. But it's for me, man. I'm trying to gain competence. You know, I talk to people that are better at things than I am or are experts in places that I am not, and try to fast-forward the competence that I can gain and bring to the listeners at the same time. Now, I mean, I play dummy, you know, unless it's just me pontificating by myself on a podcast.
Okay.
Well, we're trying the new recorder, and welcome to the Cognitive Rampage podcast. I am going to do I'd like to kind of freestyle the intro, but you've done too many things to do a freestyle to let slip out. So, to let the people know on the podcast, this is Alistair McCall, an internationally recognized leader in the field, athletic performance enhancement, 20 years experience, work with Grand Slam champions, Olympians, world-class athletes, a variety of sports, and I mean a variety, probably sports you may not even heard of if you're not cultured, but some very large international sports that are huge. But he's a sought-after speaker. He's been presented in over 25 countries worldwide, appeared on numerous TV shows, United States, sharing the competence, the experience. That's what we do on the Cognitive Rampage, so that's what we're trying to do. You love speaking. You've been all over, man. Look at that, 25 countries, assignments from the Netherlands, Olympic Federations, Australian Tennis, USPTA, NCAA, initials of everything, currently based in USA, Florida. You consult with a million teams, coaches, colleges. Yeah, I mean, let's just say the epitome of athletic training today, right?
I think there's thanks for having me, first of all, Adam. It's an honor being here. I think there's a lot more trainers that probably have done more than me, so but yeah, I've been very blessed to do what I do and to be working with all levels of athletes. So yeah, I'm very happy and very very lucky.
Well, I left out something too, and that is your new book, The 7 Keys to Becoming a Great Coach. And that just came out. It's getting a lot of love. A lot of copies are getting sold. I'm from a family of coaches, per se, if you will. Sorry, I'm having a little headphone freak out. Yeah, I'm from a family of coaches. My brother actually currently is a head coach up in Alaska. He's been a head football coach for years. I played for a long time, coached for a little while. Always into some coaching stuff and new eras and the new changing of coaches. But before we get into all of what you've done and what I've tried to learn from the method to sharing some experiences you've had, I know you're from Johannesburg. Take me from there. What walked you all the way here and brought you to sunny Florida and the journey you've been on? Walk me through the little McCall, if you will.
Okay. Well, first of all, I was actually born in Belfast, Northern Ireland. And that wasn't my choice, of course. That was my parents' choice. And I lived there until I was 6 years old. Me and my three brothers to South Africa for a better life and better weather. And yeah, we grew up there. I was there from 81 and was educated in South Africa. Was very lucky with the fact that I was brought up in a sporty family. My mother was a great athlete. She was a 400-meter Olympic trialist. So, you know, that pedigree was there. Very disciplined, very structured, probably a little bit much like yourself, you know, coming from a family of coaches. We like structure, we like routine. So there was always that in my house. And I think that's something that is so important, you know, maybe going off the subject a little bit here, but just having that foundation being brought up with having routines and structures and sport teaching us that as well. But very lucky because in South Africa, our schools were very serious about sports and kids playing more than one sport in school. So, I mean, I would sometimes end up playing 3, 4, 5 sports after school in the afternoon. And we had a very high level there as well. It was very competitive. So that's where I got my love for sport and my love for not just team sports, but individual sports as well. I started off wanting to be a professional tennis player. That didn't work out. I changed sports at 14. I found I was a pretty handy runner, maybe because of my mom's genes coming through there. From there, progressed on to triathlon and duathlon, which is the running and biking. I won the South African National Juniors twice and then got selected to represent South Africa at the World Championships in 94 in Australia. And went on to race another 5 world championships over a span of 9 years, 10 years. So I've been very blessed to have both sides of being a professional athlete, per se, and seeing that side of it, especially in a sport where it's very tough. You're not making much money. You're spending hours upon hours out training. So it's definitely a sport where if you don't have a passion or a love for it, you know, why are you doing it? Because you're not really getting anything else from it. You're not going to become rich from a sport like that. So that taught me a lot about discipline and a lot about all the important things of values and time management you know, what you put in is what you get out. At the same time, when I was doing my training, I obviously had to supplement my income. So at 16, I had already started working in gyms, and I started as vacuuming the floors, and I would do that in the mornings, and then I'd work in a restaurant in the evenings, and in between that I would do my studies and my training. So probably some nights getting 4 or 5 hours of sleep a night, but putting in the work, and paying for my triathlon habit and my studies as well. You know, that wasn't we didn't have a lot of money in the family, so that didn't come from my parents. I had to get out and work for it, and I'm so happy I did because it's taught me so much later on. Yeah, started working in gyms when I was 16. Loved it. Became a fitness trainer. Became a personal trainer. Then started to get some great clientele, athletes. And then from there, it went to working with a higher level of athlete, and you know, here I am today. Living the dream. It was always my dream as a young boy to come to America because that's where like sports performance, the Hollywood of sports performance is here in the United States when you look at it from the outside. So I just feel I'm living the dream. I'm in Florida working with professional athletes every day and also recreational athletes, of course. And just loving it. I feel so blessed. You know, somebody asked me the other day, what would you do if you could do anything and get paid the same? And I said, I'd do what I'm doing right now. I just love what I do.
Yeah, man, that is definitely living the dream when you can find what you love and do it for a living. I want to back up at 14 or so. I understand what it's like to kind of be a cultivated athlete from childhood. And the gladiator-like environment and schedules almost it can create. And when we lose an identity like the football player, the tennis player, it can become difficult. And I wonder when you dropped the tennis thing or it didn't work out as you rotated, was that a difficult transition mentally for you doing that, even at a young age? Because you seem pretty put together at that age already anyway.
Yeah. I think it was. It was more of a disappointment. I could see it was a challenge on my parents financially, you know, because I got to a level where I was knocking on the top 10 of my age group in the country, and then that was without getting coached. I coached myself. I would watch other coaches training players, and I'd write down notes. This is when I was 12, 13. So I was always like trying to find a way of how I could get better. I remember, you know, just hitting against the wall until it was dark and wow. You know, just doing those. Yeah, I there's that passion and that want so much. And this is what I try to relay on to parents today is that, you know, pushing a kid is going to push them eventually out of the sport. The ones that rise to the top are intrinsically motivated. They want it. They want it bad. They want it more than anybody. They don't need to be pushed. They need to be supported. Yes. That's the difference.
Oh, man, you get me psyched up because, you know, you talk about that it factor, right? That born with it kind of. AJ Hawk was on a podcast not long ago talking about his dad didn't have to push him to get up. He would wake his dad up at 1 a.m. to go to the batting cage, and that's he played baseball too. Not just football. He had that.
Those are traits of a champion, yep.
Right, he had that. And I think a lot of parents run into frustration trying to push that it factor onto their child and really screw up some relationships that way. But I'm so glad you teach it that way. And I want to go back to that. I get it because I have a 16-year-old that is up in volleyball. And the club travel pay, what we pay to compete for coaching and training, I swear I could buy another house. Like, you could mortgage and invest.
Yep.
And, you know,
unfortunately. It's expensive. Yep.
Yeah. And, you know, affording private coach. Because if you don't do it, they can't compete on a skill level, you know. And so you have to fork that out. So I can see now. I get it. You didn't tell the whole humble story why you had to actually to stop. But it led us to the it factor, though. I mean, I'm glad that you talk about that it factor, that intrinsic, that push, that self-determination, rather than this external locus of control.
Exactly. I mean, it's like I said, the cream will rise to the top, and the best athletes are just, you know, so they want it. They want it more than anybody. They're like I said, they're intrinsically motivated. That fire is within, and that's what I had when I was young. And like I said, I was willing to do anything to learn. I would sit and watch coaching sessions. I'd ask questions. I'd want to ask the club pro what he did when he was my age. And I had that intuition already at 12, 13 to try and figure things out. I'd question things. I remember getting in trouble sometimes in school with the physical education teachers, was asking them why they warmed up that way. Why didn't we have maybe a warm-up jog first of all? I remember getting told that with my attitude, I wasn't going to amount to much because I questioned everything. And I was young. I was like, okay. And sometimes adults can say the things they don't even realize. Luckily, I was more in a stubborn way of, nope, I'll show you. You know, I'll make it. And that is something that's still, I'm not a person about revenge or whatever, but adults can say things that can be very impactful, sometimes very, very hurtful. So we have to just be careful as adults and be careful as teachers to what we say. You know, it can make a big influence on kids.
Yeah, what I actually speak about sometimes, I'm talking to about 1,500 kids on the 19th, but I talk a lot about performance versus value, and I've also kind of been talking about a thing that I call athlete's depression, something I think it's real. Maybe we'll get to that later. But part of that ideology is, as a young athlete, you are almost raised to define your value based on how you perform. So if you don't perform well, then you don't have personal value. And a lot of parents that become coaches almost to the child really blur those lines between the value of the person or the child and their performance, that it's an effort separation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we see it so much, especially here in Florida, because there's a lot of junior programs here in golf and tennis. And, you know, here it is. You have parents where it becomes an ego thing as well of they feel that their status or their thing. It's not about the kid anymore. It's about the parent and the prestige there as well. And of course, of getting their kid into a big school, for example. You know, I've seen, I've worked up in Boston and seen that particular area there with how much parents will do to get their kids into an Ivy League school and how much money they're willing to pay coaches or specialists to give their kid the best chance. So there's a lot of pressure involved there. We can see why kids drop out of sport or sometimes rebel. But yeah, parents are a huge factor in the kids' development and also just keeping kids in sport as well. We see that Over 70% of kids stop sport at the age of 13.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Those are proven stats. Those are proven. Quit sport by the age of 13 due to burnout, injuries, lack of enjoyment, parent pressure. So it's a very disturbing stat.
Yeah, it is. And when I was doing some community counseling for a while, fresh out of school, I was seeing a lot of teenagers dealing with anxiety coming from the performance, coming from the grades performance, the chasing the scholarship, right?
Yep.
Yeah, it gets pretty intense. In training, I know you focus also on adults. You're kind of everywhere with who you talk to and who you train. And to kind of jump us forward, when you do see it, when you do see an athlete, whether that's pro or recreational, get derailed mentally, where do you usually see that gets, where's that trip up usually at?
Well, I mean, you always have to go back to, you always have to go back to the stability that they have at home. That's an important area as well. Who do they have? Who's their support team away from their sport? Is it a good support team? Do they want the best for that person? You know, that's where it all starts. That's the foundation. The foundation to a great athlete is obviously a good upbringing, a healthy upbringing, for example. There's always going to be athletes that have what we call pushy parents or whatever it may be, and that is necessary. You do need that parent that is supportive and taking you to every practice and behind you. I mean, we just look at the story of the gymnasts, of just the recent Olympics, Simone Biles and Gabby Douglas, for example, of just how much time and money and sacrifice is made by their parents and the rest of the family as well. You know, it's Gabby Douglas, I just read in Success magazine last month, just how much the family had to relocate and change their lifestyles just around her, just around that Olympic dream, for example. But yeah, it starts there, Adam. The foundation is the family. The foundation is the people that are around that athlete. How strong is that? That's important. Are they surrounded by the right people? When they start to reach an elite level or they get a little bit of fame in college, for example, or they go into professional sport, there's these people that come out of nowhere that start hanging around with them, that flash money, that are taking them to nice restaurants, that are giving them the lifestyle, and they can easily get sucked into that. And I've seen it working with athletes where there's these people that are around them during their professional career and they're nowhere to be seen afterwards. It's a sad occurrence. But yeah, that's definitely where it starts.
Yeah, the dreaded entourage of the failure of many, many professional athletes and performers, right? The game, if you will, gets caught up, the fashion, the fame, and I can see.
Exactly.
And you know what you reference, I happen to believe myself too, is that environment around the athlete, the fighter, the whatever that you are, the performer. It's I would agree. I appreciate you saying that, because I actually mental train athletes, not in the ring. I'm not Mr. Miyagi. I'm not the you. I'm not how to do it in the ring. I, with a therapist background, I help keep their life balance outside of the ring, outside of the gym. That's where I focus my mental training. Guys like you do the coaching, get your mind right for the workout, for the competition, during the competition. I mean, look at you do all that competition, right? So, do you still compete now, right?
Well, I wouldn't say I still compete, but I mean, I still enjoy running marathons and I enjoy the journey and the preparation, and I find that's a great way to let's put it this way. I love what I do. I could sit up all night and just learn about coaching and people and becoming a better coach. So finding things like planning and training for marathons or whatever that takes me a little bit out of it. That's my escape, for example. But otherwise, I'd just be absorbed in coaching athletes all day long. I usually find myself the only person in a gym on a Friday night working with clients, and it's not because I'm a workaholic. This is what I love to do. I love to be around people that want to get better. That energizes me.
And, you know, with your background, it seems like almost coaching or what you do now, I think coaching is almost a very simple term for what you actually provide and do. But, I mean, it almost seems like that was set in the cards. But can you remember a time, and mix maybe with that time, a person where you were like, I want to coach. I want to be in that influential position.
There's been a few influences in my life and my coaching. My mother was the first one, somebody that taught me about the harder you work, the more reward you're going to get. She also taught me that life isn't always fair, so suck it up and move on. I had a great track and field coach in school, Mrs. Foster, a female coach. I always seem to respond better with women coaches. There seem to be more discipline. There seem to be more of a respect of a strict but a fair female coach. And you know, I really wish there would be more women coaches in our industry.
Probably because the respect to your mom. You probably have a hardcore respect in that area watching your mom do what she does. So that becomes someone to respect. Yeah.
Absolutely. So yeah, I had great teachers in school. Very highly disciplined, but fair. There was a great balance there, and that's the quality of a good teacher, a good coach. There's been a few influences. When I was 16, 17, I was very inflexible, and I knew if I wanted to become an international athlete, I had to improve there. So I went to a ballet teacher's class every Saturday morning, and I was what's that movie called? You know that kid that goes to a ballet class, Billy. You know, there's a movie a few years ago about the only boy in the class. Well, I was the only guy in a ballet group of around about 30 professional ballet and dancers, and you can just imagine how awkward I felt. But it got me a better athlete. It got me better flexibility. I was already putting myself in a very uncomfortable situation there already, but it improved me. And she was a fantastic mentor, a fantastic teacher. She would lock the door at 8 o'clock on the dot. If you were 8:01, you were not in the class. She was tough on you. She was, you know, she taught me how to handle criticism and feedback, that it was going to better me. And I had such a high respect for it. What I find today is, you know, you got to be careful what you say. And, you know, the child's going to end up in therapy if you, you know, gave them some feedback the wrong way about their backhand or their whatever it may be. So definitely the way we've had to communicate with this generation today is a lot different to what it was. I would say in the sports performance industry, people that have influenced me greatly would be Mark Verstegen, who is a professional in his business, always dresses professionally, speaks well. He's been a pioneer in our industry. Michael Boyle in Boston has also been a fantastic mentor, even though he probably doesn't know that. So those have been some people that have influenced me. But I'd say every single coach I've come into contact with has taught me something. It's either taught me what to do or what I shouldn't do as a coach. So, you know, we can learn from everybody. I learn from the interns that come into our club here in Boca Raton, of you know, how they conduct themselves and their interpersonal skills and the simple things like just saying hello to members, simple things that can go a long way, which is forgotten.
Yeah, I think you speak a lot of the unsung heroes, which are those underpaid coaches in those schools that really do it for the love, not the paycheck. They're out there on the field spray painting it for no extra pay. You know, they're putting in those hours. I had one or two of those coaches. Shout out Coach Mitchell, Coach Bush. You know, you have some times to where they're just maybe a conversation or six throughout the season, but then you're closer. And it's usually the coach you start out hating in the beginning that you're like,
yep,
fuck that guy. And then, you know, by the end of the season, you're like, fucking love that guy. You know what I mean? They prove it to you. And they're, you know, I think my brother speaks for those unsung heroes that really put the time and the effort in and cultivate us. And, you know, I think to move kind of forward beyond that, I wonder, you know, being good at so many sports as you were and focusing on that and also seeing so many athletes that are the best at what they do. do you find when you were getting better, or the athletes that do get better are that super athlete, do they exercise a humility or more of a confidence that they know they're that good?
That obviously depends on the athlete, Adam. I'm in a very fortunate position where I can type of choose my athletes that I want to work with, and I know not everybody's in that luxury. I choose good character. I want to put my energy into bettering the athlete and not having to work continually on the person. That doesn't mean I don't want to go there. One of the first things I do with young athletes is teach them good values, good principles, respect. One of the standards I have for my young athletes coming into the club here is that they say hello to all the coaches, the trainers. When they come in, they don't just walk in. So those are high standards that I expect. They also say goodbye. They thank other coaches, or they thank the manager for being there. Those standards and principles are very important for me, because that's a reflection of me. In fact, 6 weeks ago, I had to remove a kid from our program because just of the way they were, the parents were conducting themselves at tournaments. And that doesn't represent what McCall Method is about. It doesn't represent what I'm about. And sometimes you have to make those calls. You know, they do all the right things here, but outside they're not doing the right things. You know, they're arguing with referees and umpires, and his behavior was poor and on countless occasions. And that's when I have to let a player go, and a very good player as well. So that represents my brand. That represents everything that I do, because otherwise, well, people are going, well, hey, you teach all these things, but you realize that some of the kids that train with you are acting like idiots in tournaments and so on and so forth. So sometimes you have to make those calls.
Yeah, I did a couple interviews that I never aired. It was a show I was putting together with some volleyball recruiters, and interviewing them all and just asking questions while I was at these tournaments. And you know, almost every one of them responded, the first thing we look at is the parent. They say, we're looking at the parent, yep, and we're watching the athlete actually in between plays. We want to see the response after a failure. We want to see the parent's reaction. They're watching all the things that you don't really think they're watching.
Correct. I'm trying to remember where I read it last week, where those exact words were spoken, where the coach did say they're watching the parents more than the actual kid that they're going to recruit, how they respond to situations. Alex Ferguson, the Manchester United soccer manager of 27 years, he would say that he would always invite the mother into the first meeting to see how the player spoke to the mother and how they interacted, because that would tell a lot about the player's character as well. And, you know, that was very fascinating to hear as well, just how important the parents are, especially in recruiting. I think it's probably the biggest thing in college recruiting is the parents and the upbringing of the kid, the character, because things can be sugar-coated. It can be a great athlete. They say all the right things in their interview, and then it's a different story once the kid is in the program, you know?
Yeah, we see it a lot, man, and I look for it. I didn't mean to cultivate that finding. I just happened to interview over, I don't know, 15, 20 tournaments from Division I on down, and this common theme kept popping out. You know, it was the parents. And they also said they watched what the parents packed the girls for lunch. They were literally watching what they were feeding them. They were watching how the kids would respond to the parents. I mean, and let me tell you, if some of these people thought YouTube Little League videos are bad, come to a volleyball tournament and watch these parents that are paying 10 grand a month lose their fucking minds and act like, I mean, it's terrible, you know, but they watch all that stuff and all for that scholarship.
Yeah. You know, fascinating you should say that. Today we had one of our first impact coaches round tables, and that's a monthly meeting that I've gathered of coaches of all levels of all sports to gather together. It's a very unique event that we can share, we can connect. We have a speaker each month, and today they were just speaking about that with regards that the parents take the losses harder than the kids. So that's an important area to deal with. And we had a soccer coach here who runs a huge soccer club up in West Palm Beach, and you know, he was sharing his insights about dealing with parents and dealing with loss and failure, and how the parents deal with it, never mind the child deals with it. So there's so many dynamics that we need to look at there.
Yeah, it's a lot. And you see some of the nutrition. I had two topics that actually hit my head. When you know, we talked briefly about when the parent becomes the coach, you know, it always makes me wonder, you know, who does the kid come to, or the athlete come to, when it's just tough, when they just need to purge or cry or need the friend or the fan? You know, if you're the dad or mom coach, who does the kid have then, you know?
Exactly. And it all comes down to knowing your roles and explaining the roles of each person before you start in the program. And that's another area in the standards that I have as well, is that the coach coaches, the parent supports, and the player plays. It's as simple as that. And we don't overstep those boundaries. One of the first conversations I have with parents is where that borderline is. And I also coach them on what to say and what not to say, because I can have that athlete in front of me here in the gym or on the court or on the track, wherever it is. And all that information that I've taught them can be broken down and ruined on the car drive home on the way back. Oh. And, you know, here's the thing. I only get to maybe influence an hour a day of an athlete. The rest of the time, they're either with, obviously, they're at school, but they're with their parents or they're at home, for example. So the biggest changes and the biggest influences have to happen within the home. So it's our job as coaches, which I find not enough are doing, and confronting that not so nice to do thing, is educate the parents. Because when you can win the parents and you can educate those parents on how and what to say and when to say the things, you're going to get a better result for that athlete and for the whole spectrum, the coach, the player, and the parent.
Man, you watched my head drop back when you said in one statement the parent can ruin all work in the car ride home. Oh, my brother, are you speaking the truth, man? I mean, shit. If I played a bad game and I knew what I was about to go home to, and I was forced to watch film. When game was over, there was no Denny's or McDonald's. Oh, wow. I was come home, watch film, and we would watch film, and my dad's favorite word was lethargic, and I would just get tore apart. And sometimes I'd play great, same thing. And there's a documentary out called Trophy Kids by a guy named Chris Bell, who's been on the podcast. And he did man, it's so worth to watch it. They did a smaller version.
Trophy Kids.
Yeah, they did a smaller version on HBO Sports, but the big one's on iTunes, worth the long one. There's a father in there who's pushing his kid to play football. I'll try not to give it away. A little spoiler alert.
Right.
But the kid doesn't have it. You know what I mean? And the father is
going,
waking the kid up at 5 a.m. He doesn't really even have the skills anyway. And it's just tearing this kid apart. And Chris told us on the podcast, he said, you know, Chris travels with a large security guy. And he said he had to get out of that car on the car ride home and tell that dad, like, look, I'm going to have to leave, or I'm going to have my friend here beat the shit out of you. You know what I mean? I don't think parents realize how that one sentence, that one thing, you know, can really affect, you know, all the expert work done by the pro coaches that are really helping that athlete.
Yeah. You know, sometimes there's just no off switch. The kid's getting in the car, they're hearing about it. They're at the dinner table, they're hearing about it. They're hearing about it in front of the TV. They're hearing about it when they get up. There's just no off switch. And that's what drives kids eventually out of sport. And the parent thinks they're helping. And they're not in the long term, you know. So, that's such an important area. I'm working with a kid right now who started around about 2 weeks ago, and so far so good. You know, I said to the father, so how does it work with the team? He says, I don't watch any of his matches. It's I prefer not to. He prefers it as well. And I said, well, job well done, because there's a lot of parents that won't accept that, you know. So he stays away from the matches, supports his kid from afar, makes sure that the kid has good coaches, and then steps back and lets them take care of that. And we have a fantastic relationship, feedback. He says, hey, give me a call whenever if there's anything that my son's not doing, you're not happy with, or whatever it may be, you know. And so he's a father. And because it's not my place to discipline a kid with behavior and such, there's standards within the club, but it's not my place to change family values and standards. So there's a great dynamic there as well. So that's how can I put it? But I've really wanted to work myself into a position where it was one of my goals that I could eventually choose the people I wanted to work with. And I know not everybody has that luxury, but when you work hard and you set your standards and you put things out there, you're going to lose some people. But here's the thing: you're going to lose the people you don't want anyway. That headache, is that headache and that stress worth that extra $500 a month or whatever it may be, you know? And that's an important area. Why I love my work so much, so many reasons, is because I don't have those stresses of dealing with behavioral issues with parents and so on, because the standards are set from day one. And like I said, I removed a kid and the family from my program 6 weeks ago, and there was a clear understanding. You violated these rules. We've spoken about it. I'm sorry. I'm not the person for you. And that's how we move on.
Yeah, I think keeping that regimen helps keep the athlete in check too, especially if they're really good. You can see it very easily developing a complex into, you know, the superstar theory of that. I mean, you see it sometimes in smaller sports. The kid that's the fastest doesn't come to practice or kind of misses and loafs, right? And you see that a lot. So I think keeping the equal across the board is important. And, you know, speaking of losing stuff, when I want to kind of talk about maybe how you help an athlete deal with a direct loss, you know, not making the Olympic team, maybe not coming home with gold, or after a long 3 month, you know, training camp, you know, coming out, you know, not in victorious, not as a winner in the competition. How do you approach that with them?
Obviously, there's got to be compassion. I've been there myself, where I've missed the podium in a world championships by coming fourth. And fourth is the worst position you can be in when there's a gold, silver, bronze. You know, you're really the first loser, if you want to call it, of not meddling. And I know how that feels. It's devastating. You've put all this work in. You've been through the journey. But those are the losses that teach you so much. They teach you about yourself a lot. Who are you? How do you bounce back from those setbacks? So I try to use my experience with the athletes I work with when they've had disappointment. I worked with an athlete a few years ago that made the Olympic team for Beijing, but had an injury, injured herself a month before, and had to skip out of the team. Now, that's devastating to miss your first Olympics, and you've qualified for the Olympics. So there's going to be compassion as a coach. Again, the importance of the right people around them, that support network, and also just to keep that athlete in perspective, that they have the qualities, they have what it takes. Keep working hard. These things will only benefit you later. You might not see it now, but in the long-term picture, you're going to be not only a better athlete, but a stronger human being. So you need to keep looking and searching for those positives and reinforce the athlete with them, you know, build their confidence, compliment them, but make sure it's genuine compliments, not false compliments, you know. So that's very important. You know, one of my favorite sayings is by Jim Rohn. You know, you become the five people you spend the most time with. You know, so that's important as well, who you surround yourself with. But I deal with it a lot, Adam. You know, tennis players, for example, each week you're a loser almost every week, because if you're not Roger Federer, Serena Williams, whatever, you're losing every week in a tournament. So how do you deal with loss every single week? Because there's only one winner out of 128 players in a draw. So it's an important fact. You know, I always like to say to my athletes, you never lose if you've learned. So always learn from that, move on.
That goes perfectly, actually. The next question is, it overtime, I mean, I understand wins affect, but from an athletic personal development standpoint, do you see losses positively affecting the athlete or better more than wins? Which one do you actually see in a additional and in an add-on, right? What really adds on more, the losses or actual wins? Obviously, winning records help everything else in rankings and money, et cetera, obviously. But I mean from an athletic personal development.
That's where a great coach comes in, is knowing how to help that athlete once they've lost or once they've had a disappointment. But great athletes hate to lose more than they love to win. That is one of the traits I've found in a great athlete. I'm just busy on my second book, which goes into about the fact that the best athletes that I've worked with or seen, they hate to lose more than they love to win. Dealing with loss is a very important part of not just sport, but part of life as well. Winning motivates. Winning definitely motivates. Winning builds confidence. So you want to try to get that momentum going of winning, for example. But here's the thing, you know, you can have a player in a tournament that wins four matches and then loses one. And what are they taking with them when they pack their bags and they get on the plane? They lost. Their last player was a loss. So you've got to keep it in perspective for them, their performance that week, how well they played. Go more into the ratio of 3-1 of the things they did well that week. Reinforce the good. And then obviously say, hey, we need to work on A and B. That's why I felt that, you know, you let that match slip or whatever it may be. But, hey, you're doing this well. We worked on that. That's come right. So you just continue to keep reinforcing those positives, and that's how you keep that confidence in that athlete instead of just forgetting about those four matches and just going into that last match, how bad it was and why were you acting like this and so on and so forth. There you don't realize it, but you're actually breaking down their confidence. You think you're helping, but you're breaking down their confidence because they've forgotten about those four wins or those four good matches, for example. So that's an important area.
Do you find that an athlete, say on a win streak or so, can become overconfident? And if so, how do you manage, say, an athlete that is on a 8-fight win streak or a, you know, 9-game win streak? Is there overconfidence? How do you balance that? How do you, you know, not burst their bubble, right? Because you don't want to pull that down. How do you even them out, if you will, or keep them that way, or recognize when they are too far?
No, I wouldn't say there's that's a delicate area. I wouldn't say there's overconfidence. That is the goal, is to get the athlete as confident as possible. However, there's a difference between cockiness and confidence, where they're starting to lose perspective of reality, or they're starting to behave in a poorer way because of their, if you want to call it, overconfidence. Overconfidence, I'm looking for overconfidence in a player. The more confidence confident I can get them, the better. However, overconfidence is seen as acting in a poor way, entitled, cocky, etc. Then that's where I say to the athlete, hey, keep them grounded in a way of remember to say thank you to the officials, say thank you to the ball boys or whoever it may be, for example, you know. But overconfidence, no, I try not to go in there. But however, poor behavior or entitlement or cockiness, that is where I'd step in and say something.
Yeah, the confidence definitely is the push, but when you do start to back out and believe that confidence brings you other rights, or you don't have to work as hard, or, you know, you see that. You see athletes that do reach a pinnacle, believe themselves to be at the top. They don't work as hard. They pull out a little bit, and you see them regress even. And you know, obviously that can lead to a quick end of, you know, career, if you will. So I kind of want to go to that and how much you've seen or what you see happen in the mind of an athlete whose career does come to an end when the age has done it, injury has done it, or, you know, something natural or maybe just cut even, right? When you see that end of transition, how do you help them approach that or see that coming or cope with that?
Okay. Good question. That is an area where I found lately, probably in the last 5 years, I've had a lot of athletes that are near retirement or have retired get in touch with me to talk about life after sport, because it is a vacuum. And especially if you've been in a sport where you haven't maybe made enough money to live the lifestyle you want after sport, which is for the very elite few and only a few selected sports where you've made enough money, then it's tough because for the first time in their lives, they're going to be working in an office or holding down a job, for example, or learning how to deal with a whole set of different skills. So I always like an athlete to have a five-year plan in front of them. So, you know, they have an idea of when they might retire, for example, or they have an idea of what they're going to be doing after that and already start preparing for that, be it through a simple study or be it through learning a little bit more about the industry, for example, and not just stopping their sport one day and then not knowing a clue about how things work or whatever business they want to go into. So I already start asking those questions around, for example, if let's just say the average age of that sport stops at 35, around the age of when they hit 30, and so, you know, have you thought about after sport, what you want to do and what field you want to go into and how you're going to go there? Obviously, also to start make connections. Don't just start trying to make connections and once you're finished, already start building up those relationships, because your chance of getting hired or your chance of being in a business or going into an area are people that you've already built up relationships with. So this is an important area as well, is that they're already starting to network while they're still playing. And here's the thing. They've got to take advantage of the time that they're still playing, that they're still, call it, in the spotlight, because they're interesting people. And as we know, businesses, companies like to have interesting people or athletes that they like to say they know or are connected with. So they've got to take advantage of that and not wait until their career is finished.
And you point out a lot. I mean, the second book that I'm writing is called The Killing Fields, Athlete's Depression. And like I said previous, with my mental health background, the counseling background, I'm working on an actual etiology that would define this almost as a diagnosis, this athlete's depression, because it's very specific, because you're raised a specific way, specific rules, etc. When that's ripped from you, your identity, if you will, can become. So it's so good to hear someone that is high up in the profession and the time doing this, paying attention to that, being aware of that, seeing that, and almost in a pre-counseling almost method, preparing, you know, the athlete for that coming, and to connect that. Yep. With a high school athlete, maybe you're training, that doesn't get the scholarship, do you see it on that same level being just as effective and detrimental to the athlete as say, a professional that's just leaving a job as an athlete?
Yeah, for sure. You've got to have a plan. I mean, you've got to have an idea of what you want to do, for example, in 3 years and 5 years, 5 years' time. Now I know that tomorrow is not even a guarantee, but you've definitely got to have an idea of what field and what sector you want to go into. So as a coach, it's my job as well to try and prepare that athlete for that journey and help them in any possible way of leads and connections and even, hey, let's go spend a day at that particular thing you want to do and see if you like it, if you enjoy it. You know, so yeah, it's a very important area for sure.
Oh man. Well, I figure to wrap something up, because I want to tease them. I think we've already been kind of walking through your book a little bit and some of your method, and rather than give them the direct, let's float them out with some teasers and walk them into the McCall method, but then make them go learn the rest later by getting deep into it. So that foundational approach to the McCall method, kind of walk me in a little bit. You know, I'm ordering the book anyway. And maybe one or two of those keys to focus on from that book. For a lot of coaches and athletes are very in tune with the show. So try to give them a little bit of that taste of that competence, you know?
Yeah. The book starts with, it all starts with your standards. And that's where it starts, no matter what field you're in, what you're doing. It starts with your standards, the standards you set for yourself. In other words, how you're going to live your life. What are the rules you have for your life? What are you going to accept? What aren't you going to accept? That's the most important thing. The second thing is the standards you have for where you work or your business or your academy or wherever it may be. And the third standard, if you're a coach, is the standards you have for your athletes and the parents in that program as well. Those are the three important standards that we start with. Obviously, there's seven keys. I'm not going to go through all seven keys, but another important one is bringing a great energy. Attitude costs you nothing, but it can get you so far. You know, you get to choose your attitude every morning. AM is an abbreviation for morning. Well, I call it attitude management. Before you step out of the door in the morning, make sure you have an attitude management. Get that right. This is what I tell young people is that you're not only going to be hired for your resume or what school you went to or what your grades were. They're looking at your attitude. They're looking at your values, your character, your time management. These small things that are so important. Your likability, your best like you because your interpersonal skills are going to get you much further than your grades. You've got to be able to get on with people. So, put the egos away. Say hello to people, get to know people, become a friendly person. That's an important area, and invest in yourself every day. I invest in myself by ordering 2 books a month, for example, off Amazon. I invest in myself by going to conferences. I invest, for example, in myself in organizing coaches meetings like today, where we can sit around and share a lot of information. I listen to podcasts. I listen to you, for example. So you're not just investing in your own particular area or your field, but you're investing in knowledge in people. That's a very important area. So those are three key areas from the book. I'd say that I can pick out of the seven are your standards, your energy, which is your attitude, and of course investing in yourself every day.
That's called a cognitive macaw rampage. That's what that's called.
I like that.
Yeah, that's how that came out, man. I told you we would talk until we got to that point, man, where I feel like I hit that McCall button. Yes. Right there. I mean, that's you can drop the mic on that one, my friend. And
cool.
I appreciate you coming on, man. And I'd love to keep talking to you, as next year comes along, being that I'm walking into this athlete's depression, athlete's mental training field. Work with some fighters now, some MMA fighters specifically. But, just what I learned in an hour here, sitting with you, man, for me, as an applicator, as investigating what you've seen, hearing that, for me, that's speeding up learning time, That's speeding up learning time for me. So thank you.
And I appreciate your time as well and helping us learn as well. Podcasts are such a powerful way of learning and thanks so much to what you're doing, Adam.
I appreciate it, man. If you want to tell everybody where they can find you, buy the book, Twitter, the whole nine yards, man.
Sure. 7 Keys to Being a Great Coach is on Amazon.com. I'm on Twitter at Alistair McCall, and I have a Facebook page, McCall Method, MCCAW and Method. Those are the three best ways to keep in touch.
Oh, perfect, man. Definitely reach out. And if I know a lot of athletes down there in the South, East Florida, are around there in Delray, man. So you guys know where to go. They're already going to you anyway, man. So thanks again, Alistair, man. I look forward to chatting with you again soon, brother.
Awesome. Thanks, Adam. Thank you.
Take care, man.